The Devil in Connecticut. Now, when we left off, David, little David, was being exorcised. This is a terrifying, true case of demonic possession in a household in Connecticut. A little boy possessed of demons. I've taken the time already to cover the background, including their involvement with the family they used to snowmobile with in New York, that were into the occult and witchery. We have been reading enough different areas regarding this subject of demonology. I don't think I need to review tonight to those that are listening. I had taken you to the point of David's exorcism. As they were attempting, the Catholic priests, primarily Father Bergulig, again and again in the midst of the exorcism, the possessing entity brought David to the point of death, trying to blackmail the priest to stop. Many times the tactic almost worked. This was the situation at 4:30 a.m. "It's killing my baby. It's killing him," Judy shrieked, his mother, finally breaking down. "I'll kill him, I'll kill him, I swear I'll kill him," the diabolical thing declared. On the floor, David lay stone cold still. It appeared as though David had actually experienced a heart attack. The pulse and heartbeat were nil. The boy's skin grew white. His body lay motionless, seemingly depleted of life. By the time a full minute had passed, those in the room could not help but take it for real. At this uniquely wrong point in time, Arne Johnson, the fiancé, boyfriend — I'm going to have to kill this gnat here with my blowtorch again. Got a gnat flying in my eye. I mean, all things stop for a gnat, Peter. Lay your camera down and look for that gnat and kill him. I'm blowtorching to death. And my weapon just went off. At this uniquely wrong point in time, Arne Johnson, who loved David and had many times tried to protect him during physical attacks of the demon, reaffirmed the tragic mistake he had made before. All night long he had been holding David's arms and legs. All night he had fought and overpowered the physical strength of the entity. Now David lay limp, white, and apparently dying. Desperate to save David's life, Arne declared, "Let David live. Take me on. Come into me." Deep, coarse laughter promptly erupted from David's inert body. "Suckers. Fools." The action caused Lorraine, the Catholic demonologist and clairvoyant, to burst into tears. She said, "I immediately sensed that Arne Johnson had made a very grave mistake, that somehow he would be made to pay for his challenge. Not even a priest would say such a thing." Arne made the statement selflessly to help David at the expense of himself. But he was ignorant of the responsibility he was taking on by making such an invitation. He didn't know that this thing, instead of releasing David, could actually possess them both, each of them in their own way. Father Bergulik had to stop, take Arne aside, and sternly warn him, "Don't ever say that again." Now, you know that we're listening the other night. I went ahead and read the finish of the exorcism. At 6:15 a.m., September 9th, 1980, the spirit left David Glatzel. The exorcism was not complete because it was not bound But David was delivered at 6:15 from the spirit on that occasion. Arnie, however, out of compassion for David, having asked the demon to come into him, was to suffer the consequences. Chief of Police, John Anderson, Brookfield, Connecticut Police Department. This is his report. We received a call from Ed and Lorraine Warren of Monroe in October 1980. They said they were involved with a family that resided here in Brookfield, that the involvement was pertaining to a demonic possession of someone in the family, and there was potential for great danger. Ed and Lorraine, knowing the circumstances, had called the Brookfield Police Department, and Chief of Police John Anderson recorded this memorandum. March 20th, 1981, CBS Morning News reported as follows. Given the grave nature of the situation and its potential to cause alarm in a small community, all aspects of the Brookfield possession case were kept strictly confidential. The Glatzels and the Warrens remained silent on the matter. Similarly, church officials decreed that details of the possession had the status of the confessional and therefore was privileged information and could not be made public. The whole affair was shrouded in total secrecy. Indeed, it is a case no one would ever have known about had a gruesome tragedy not occurred 6 months later as the final culmination of events. The tragedy came in the form of a murder, a stabbing. It took place in Brookfield on February 16, 1981. The individual accused of the crime was Arnie Cheyenne Johnson. I might say aside, who had asked the demon to enter him. Brookfield police arrested him at 7:25 p.m. on that date, an hour after the fatal incident occurred. He was found walking along a road, reportedly in a daze. Half an hour later, Arnie was charged with murder. The police asserted that 18-year-old Arnie Johnson willfully killed a man with a long-bladed buck knife that they found at the so-called crime scene. Those present at the time of the killing, however, witnessed something entirely different. Now, what did they witness? Devil in Connecticut story is the most amazing, unbelievable, and yet true story of demon possession in a household in Connecticut. As you read the book, you find it's not an accident this family is picked. They had dabbled into the occult, particularly in association with friends they used to snowmobile with up in New York State. I have read enough of the attacks and the problems and the process into full demon possession of the young 11-year-old boy David. One unsuccessful exorcism was attempted by the Catholic priests in the Brookfield, Connecticut area. A second exorcism was in progress when I quit reading in this book in the Dallas-Fort Worth, Memphis area. Critical to the continued story I want to read, in the midst of the second exorcism of David, Arnie Johnson, the fiance of his older sister, who many times had attempted to come between David and the attacking spirit evil entities, reaffirmed that commitment. All night long, he had been holding David's arms and legs. All night, he had fought and overpowered the physical strength of the entity. Now David lay limp, white, and apparently dying. Desperate to save David's life, Arnie declared, "Let David live. Take me on. Come into me." Deep, coarse laughter promptly erupted from David's inert body. "Suckers, fools." Lorraine, the demonologist's wife and clairvoyant present, knew a mistake had been made. Father Vergulich sternly reprimanded Arnie. It was too late. Arnie did nothing to spare David. The demon now had an invitation to enter Arnie, and he could possess both. More than one were involved in possessing David. The demons who left the little boy in the New Testament, legion because they were many, possessed many pigs. The exorcism of David was completed at 6:15 a.m. September 9, 1980. Again, I'll skip over the details, having read them previously. The demon was not bound. The exorcists were somewhat inexperienced. CBS Morning News reported March 20, 1981. Chief of Police John Anderson, Brookfield Police Department. "We received a call from Ed and Lorraine Warren of Monroe in October 1980. They said they were involved with a family that resided here in Brookfield, that the involvement was pertaining to a demonic possession of someone in the family, and there was potential for great danger." The story continues. "Given the grave nature of the situation," this by the author of the book, "and its potential to cause alarm in a small community, all aspects of the Brookfield possession case were kept strictly confidential. The Glatzels and the Warrens remained silent on the matter. Similarly, church officials decreed that details of the possession had the status of the confessional and therefore was privileged information and could not be made public. The whole affair was shrouded in total secrecy. Indeed, it is a case no one would ever have known about had a gruesome tragedy not occurred 6 months later as the final culmination of events. The tragedy came in the form of a murder. A stabbing. It took place in Brookfield on February 16, 1981, the night that Arnie asked the demon to go into him, thinking by so doing he could spare David, was September 1980. October went by, November, December, January, February 16, 1981. The individual accused of the crime, none other than Arnie Cheyenne Johnson. Brookfield police arrested him at 7:25 p.m. on that date, an hour after the fatal incident occurred. He was found walking along a road, reportedly, in a daze. Half an hour later, Arnie was charged with murder. The police asserted that 18-year-old Arnie Johnson willfully killed a man with a long-bladed buck knife that they found at the so-called crime scene. Those present at the time of the killing, however, witnessed something entirely different. On an ordinary February day, without warning, the portentous threats and predictions made by the beastly demon the preceding summer came to pass. How did this come to pass? What was the link between the summer possession case and the stabbing that took place in February? Good question, isn't it? The spirit had supposedly been exorcised in September. What happened during the intervening months that caused this disaster to occur? The truth is that what began on July 2nd, 1980, the original possession, did not end on September 9th. 6:15 a.m. when David was exorcised. There was one more act that had to be played out in this mystical drama. The death scene. The combined effect of all the religious procedures conducted during the summer. Now again, I want to send a Ghostbuster back to that place to check all this out. I want to hire somebody and send them there and settle it once and for all. I'm going to send a Ghostbuster to check all this out. It's all too unbelievable. Yet it's believable. Can't be true. Yet it must be. The combined effect of all the religious procedures conducted during the summer, the blessings, the high mass, the concerted attempts at exorcism, functioned to stop the possession of David, the outrageous physical attacks on his body, and the intense phenomena in the Glatzel home. However, despite all that had been done, the spirit was not conclusively exorcised. Only the priests left. The spirit did not. As Ed Warren explains, oh, you're not interested in this. After David was exorcised, after the exorcism was completed on September 9th, 1980, Arnie Johnson, the fiance of his sister, who had cried out in the near-fatal exorcism of David for the demon to come into him and release David, Arnie is arrested for murder in February 1981. The exorcism of the 9th of September was not conclusive, as the book goes on to say. Only the priest left. The spirit did not. And you folks out there that are listening, this is one time the voices of faith are going to be frustrated. You keep them busy on the phone and they can't listen to what I'm doing. As Ed Warren explains, although the various exorcism procedures ultimately stopped the entity from possessing David, the spirit itself was not exorcised. At least not in the classical way the word is understood. And he says a mouthful there, because the church, through the centuries, has dealt with demons. The problem had to do with procedure. What was required all along was for a trained exorcist to be assigned to the case by church officials, diocesan officials, and given the authority to conduct major exorcism, the ritual Romanum. It was the only solution. There never was any other solution. What was possessing David had to be fully exorcised and then bound by command not to possess the child again and leave the family for good. Not just exorcised, but bound. Why didn't they? It's the only criticism I've ever heard these Catholic demonologists give of a section of their church. Instead, diocesan officials, accountable only to themselves, stood aloof. The devil in Connecticut, in our diocese, no one must know. We'll take care of it our own way. their way was to do too little, too late. After September 2nd, when the need for correct procedure was critical, the diocese still refused to grant authority, either for major exorcism or for an exorcist. An old man, pious with the gift of discernment, who has commanded the devil before, none of the priests who performed the exorcism qualified for that. And the diocese refused to grant authority for a major exorcism or for an exorcist to be brought in to perform the task. In the words of this writer, because of pride or politics or lack of interest, this enormous job of exorcising David, which you know took more than one attempt because of their inexperience, the enormous job was left in the hands of four young priests in the field. And they got hurt because of it. Had someone in the chancery, I read this writer and Ed and Lorraine, the only time I've ever heard of a criticism of the church for them. Had someone in the chancery gotten off their throne and observed the great evil that was taking place in Brookfield, some positive move might have resulted. But what took place instead were two otherwise dedicated attempts at lesser exorcism. The result of these deliverance procedures was to stop the entity from possessing David. But the thing was not bound and expelled. It remained free to possess another. Disaster was not stopped. It was only deferred. Further exorcism was required. But unbelievably, the Chancery closed the book on the case at that point. Believe it or not, Father Vergulich was taken off the case in late September and sent to Rome, as Father D. Giovanni, earlier involved, had been sent to Rome. The local priests were instructed to return to their regular duties. The policy diocesan officials adopted, was that if the entity wasn't possessing David, then their job was done. And they stuck with that position. Instead of cooperation came hostility. Instead of peace came tragedy. A metaphysical time bomb was left ticking, in the words of this writer. Ed Warren's statements were confirmed by the Glatzel family. All of the above was direct quote from Ed Warren. Judy, the mother of David, summed it up in one terse comment. The church abandoned us. A week after the last exorcism took place in this house, Judy said, a monk arrived here late at night in a limousine. He and his chauffeur came in and stayed an hour and a half. Father Vergulich was present that night too. This is the words of David's mother. The monk was pompous and rude. Ed Warren called him an official church debunker. He declared that we were all crazy and that David wasn't possessed, even though Father Vergulich, now sent to Rome, was present and performed the exorcism. His chauffeur blamed Debbie for all the trouble. He said the only devils that exist are Rockefeller and the crooks in Washington. He said that exorcism wasn't needed in this case, and then he left. He insulted me, my family, and Father Vergulich, who subsequently would be sent within a matter of days or weeks to Rome, banished. From that point on, we never got any help, Judy, the mother of David, said, from the diocese again. They turned their back on us. There wasn't anything we could do about it. The beast was given a free hand to act, and it did. And I'm delighted to point out that the Catholic Church is not as monolithic as some people think it is. Official policy does not always filter down and make robots out of every Christian within the Catholic Church. Ultimately, to get the job done, they're going to have to leave the New England diocese and go to Canada, to Quebec, where they find a mature exorcist who then will come down and finish the job on David. But it was too late for Arnie Johnson. Incomprehensible as it may seem, this is the situation that prevailed after the summer of 1980. The beast was given a free hand to act, and it did. The result was a downslide into catastrophe. In September, says Debbie Glatzel, the thing possessed David a few more times just to show us it was here. But toward the end of the month and into October, the figure directed its attention to little Carl and turned him into a violent madman. We were living in hell again. None of us had any way of stopping this thing. The priests had been scattered, and as a consequence, we all became victims. Carl, for example, pulled a loaded shotgun on me and threatened to rearrange my face. He sent Alan to the hospital with stab wounds in his stomach from an iron rake, and my mother was black and blue from trying to break up these battles. Most of the time, Carl's excessive anger was directed against Arnie, my mother, and me. Arnie became his favorite target. He destroyed every shred of clothing Arnie had. He cut up his music tapes. He destroyed cartons of cigarettes as soon as they were brought home. He ruined Arnie's new work boots by filling them with axle grease the day he got them. Carl, or rather the beast working through him, did everything he could to break Arnie down, but Arnie never broke. He shouldered it all. It took the beast to step in finally and ruin him. By mid-October, havoc in the family became so violent and threatening that Brookfield police were called to the Glatzels' home once, sometimes twice a week. It was only the Warrens' intercession that saved young Carl from being taken away by the police to the juvenile detention center. The police didn't know why they were perpetually responding to disturbance calls at the Glatzel property, and they were beginning to lose patience, said Lorraine Warren. In October, it became necessary to inform them in as discreet a manner as possible that a theological case was in progress with the Glatzel family, one that had required church involvement since July. It was explained that the source of the trouble was not the people, but rather an unexercised force that was oppressing them. And that's what I read earlier. The chief of police's department report in October 1980, reporting these calls from the Warrens. The potential for violence in the case had become a reality, the police were told, and even the possibility of death could not be ruled out. They were requested to keep the family under surveillance, but not to arrest anyone unless it was absolutely necessary. Fortunately, the police agreed, and the oppression of young Carl died down naturally in November. In October 1980, Mary Johnson fled the rental house in Newtown with Arnie's young sisters. Day by day, all summer and into the fall, little incidents kept building until the girls were so frightened they refused to go into the house without their mother. This is the first house where the story started. Not only did Mary Johnson and the girls see things, hear things, and feel things, but their personalities were changed by the house. They fought fiercely among themselves. Nothing went right. By October, living in the house had also broken them financially. As a result, they were forced to return to Bridgeport, where they live today. In late November, Arnie and Debbie also made a move. We're getting ready for the murder now. Debbie's job at the kennels in Newtown had been phased out in September, but the owner had recommended her to Alan Bono, the new manager of the Brookfield Kennels on Route 7, not far from the Glatzels' home. Mr. Bono telephoned Debbie in late October and offered her a job and a free apartment if she came to work for him. The apartment was in the four-unit block he managed on the property along with the kennels.
This is the end of Side 1. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for Side 2. Thank you.